My name is Saru, and well, first, I'm an attorney and a professor of political science and, above all, an organizer, but I am not a health professional of any sort. So this is my first APHA conference ever, so I apologize if I am delving into a world that I don't know as much about as the rest of you, but I certainly have a lot to say on the issue, so we'll start from that. So first, just want to let you know, actually, I don't represent Rock New York. I represent a new national restaurant workers organization called Rock United that I founded in January of this year together with restaurant workers all over the country. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background about the industry because there's a lot of things that people just don't know about this industry that are incredibly important to know. I'll try to go as quickly as I can because I only have 15 minutes. But first of all, there are three really big things happening in the restaurant industry in the United States. First, most people don't know, it is now the nation's largest private sector employer by far. This is actually a little outdated. It says 12.8 million employees. There are about 13.1 million employees nationwide, and it surpasses all other private sectors by a long shot, and it is the fastest growing industry in most urban areas nationwide. So just some examples. In New York, right after 9/11, people expected it to dip in terms of the number of folks eating out. Actually, it skyrocketed and continues to be the largest contributor to job growth in New York City. In New Orleans, where we now have a Rock, there are more restaurants post-Katrina than there were pre-Katrina. In the city of Detroit, the metro area of Detroit, which lost so many thousands of auto jobs, there are now the same number of restaurant workers in the Detroit metro area, if you can believe it, as in the five boroughs of New York City. So the industry just continues to grow. Even during our economic crisis and depression, people continue to eat out. In fact, maybe they eat out more when they're depressed. So you can see it's huge. It's a huge, huge, huge and growing industry. It's expected to add another 2 million jobs over the next decade for total employment, about 15 million jobs in 2018. As manufacturing jobs have left the United States, this is the industry that's taking over in a really big way. The second big trend that most people don't know is that we see three segments in the industry, what we call fine dining tablecloth restaurants, what we call family style or franchise, which is everything from Olive Garden to your average ethnic restaurant, and what we call quick serve, which is essentially anything without a waiter, Avanpan to Burger King. And the restaurants that hold the most power, influence, have the most money lie in that top fine dining segment. There's been tremendous conglomeration over the last 10 years in that top segment, so that restaurants that you think are independently owned, these fancy fine dining restaurants, are actually what we call mini empires. So we coined this term about 5 years ago. It's basically a restaurant ownership group. Many of them have 10 or 20 around the country. So one example is Be Our Guest, which has a lot of fancy restaurants in New York, Chicago, and Las Vegas. Another example is Dickie Brennan's restaurants in New Orleans. As I said, we now organize in New Orleans, which has 10 establishments. None have the same name. You would never know they belong to the same company. So what does this growth mean and this conglomeration? It, of course, means greater power for employers and less for workers. So we see tremendous problems in the workplace. Unfair tip distribution, meaning tip stealing, wage theft, discrimination, sexual harassment, no job security, you know, tons of undocumented workers, and very abusive management, no overtime, and of course, very, very, very high risk of injury and illness, tremendous health and safety problems on the job. And I will say that all of these problems exist just as much in that fine dining segment, if not more, than in the other segment. So there's this common mythology that it's the little ethnic restaurants that are the shady employers, when in fact it's these big, high-profile fine dining restaurant companies that are really exploiting their workers in a big way. So these are the three big trends that we see in this industry. So a little bit of history. Rock United is a new national restaurant organization that has been setting up ROCs, restaurant opportunity centers around the country. We're doing national research and policy work. We're doing national campaigns and national convenings of restaurant workers. And it's all based on this model that we created in New York that has three prongs, because we realize with such a large and powerful industry that we'll never succeed by doing one thing or another, that we really have to surround the industry in multiple ways. And so we've been really successful at creating consequences for the folks we call low road actors, people who are taking the low road to profitability. And they're low road, but they darn are high profile. So these are really fancy, really expensive restaurant companies that we've created terrible consequences for them for taking the low road. We're at the same time promoting the folks that are taking the high road, doing the right thing, providing good wages, good working conditions, proper health and safety. And at the same time, we're doing a lot of research and policy work. So it's all based on an organization we started in New York right after the World Trade Center collapsed. On September 11th, there was a restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center called Windows on the World. And on that day, 73 workers died and about 300 workers lost their jobs. I was called in by Unite Here, which at that time was HERE, to start a new organization in the aftermath of the tragedy together with the workers that would initially provide support to all the workers who had lost their jobs, but in the long run really create a labor-friendly climate and begin to think about the 99.9% of the industry that's non-union. So in New York City, Windows was one of maybe 40 restaurants in the city out of 15,000 or 20,000 that have a union. So that means, you know, less than 1% of all restaurant workers in New York City are unionized, and that's the highest union density of any restaurant industry anywhere in the country. So less than 0.1% of all restaurant workers nationwide, that 13.1 million, are unionized, and that means that we've got a big job to do. These are photos from every year we hold a special memorial down by the World Trade Center for the Windows workers because they are always forgotten. And so our organization has grown. I just want to talk a little bit about the three prongs. This first prong, we use a combination of litigation, as I mentioned, I'm an attorney, and organizing to ultimately win settlement agreements that resemble union contracts. So we've been able to win things like promotions policies, job security, grievance procedures, raises, promotions, paid sick days, paid holidays, paid vacations, all through this really unique methodology that ends up with a settlement agreement docketed in federal court that covers thousands of workers in a high-profile fine dining restaurant company. So we've won now 9 campaigns totaling about $5 million in unpaid wages and stolen tips, but even more important for us than the money is every time we win one of these campaigns, we're able to win these great settlement agreements where we actually get policy changes like paid sick days for thousands of workers in a company. So that's one of the main prongs of our work. I'm not going to spend a lot of time there. So the second prong of our work, which is what we were in part funded for through the EJ grants, is research. So in 2003, we pulled together a coalition of folks in the city, in New York City, academics, policy folks, people from all over, workers, employers. We did a big study and published a report called Behind the Kitchen Door. It was based on 530 surveys of restaurant workers. We followed them home after their late night shift and on the subways and like tracked them down and trained our members who are restaurant workers to conduct these surveys with their fellow workers. We also did 45 worker interviews and 35 employer interviews, which were really key for us in developing relationships with high road employers. So we did it to understand the industry better, shape our strategy, raise public consciousness about working conditions, and establish us, the worker-led organization, as the experts on the industry. Not the academics, even though I'm an academic, not the academics with whom we worked, not the policymakers, but the workers themselves as the experts on the industry. And we really have succeeded in doing that. We really are seen as the credible source of information for data by journalists and policymakers on the restaurant industry. We did it, as I said, by pulling together the coalition and doing all the surveys and interviews and a ton of census regression. We went out and did lots and lots of surveys, and we found a lot of the things that I'm saying. The industry is just thriving by leaps and bounds in New York City, and there are some decent living wage jobs in the industry. That's the part that people don't know. About 20% of the jobs are living wage jobs, so waiters and bartenders in a fine dining restaurant can make up to $150,000 a year in tips. But actually, immigrants and people of color are unable to access those jobs. There's a tremendous glass ceiling or barrier that prevents immigrants and workers of color from getting to those living wage jobs. So you can see here, this kind of exemplifies the growth. That little dip, at the line that goes above is the restaurant industry, and the little dip is 9/11. But the industry has continued to skyrocket after that, and the lower level is everything else, all other employment combined. So it's a huge industry. Now it's about 200,000 workers. This is a little bit old. Median wage is about $9. 67% are foreign-born, and 40% are undocumented in New York City. So everybody's working a lot of hours, as I said, 80% are low wage or below, and a good 60% are poverty wages. So nobody has paid sick days in an industry that's cutting and preparing your food, and I'll talk more about that in a second. Nobody has health insurance, and nobody gets paid vacations. No raises, no promotions. you know, tons and tons of tip stealing, wage stealing, no breaks, doing jobs people aren't trained for, doing several practices at once. And so in this first survey, we were able to establish that there really is a really huge health and safety problem. So cuts, burns, unsafe heat, mats missing, and no guards on the machines. So a good 30% of all workers saying that they were cut, burned, I'm sorry, 46%, almost half saying they were cut, and about 40% saying they were burned on the job. And then the piece also that really shocked us in that first study was the extent of occupational segregation. As I mentioned, that it was white people holding the good jobs and people of color holding all the other jobs in a city, in New York City, that was so extraordinarily diverse. And so employers were particularly very open about that. They said, you know, we love to have pretty Miss Oregon in the front and hardworking Jose in the back. And we found tons of ads on Craigslist that said, looking for a blonde, perky waitress, photo attached, gets first reply. And of course, that's completely illegal. And then the part that was really interesting for us was that we cross-indexed the data. And we knew this was really key because we knew that consumers wouldn't care that much about worker safety and health or worker wages or that kind of stuff, but they really would care a lot about their own dining experience. And so we cross-indexed the data to show that it was the same employers who were violating employment laws and, you know, health and safety stuff as were violating consumer health code issues. And so this, you could see, is comparing high labor violations with workers putting their own safety at risk, and then high labor violations with workers saying that they were doing something because they were under time pressure that was likely to harm the health and safety of the consumer. And so there's a ton more of those slides, but I don't have a lot of time. But just to say that that was really, really key for us in making that report very important. And we actually ended up doing a second report on that basis called Dining Out, Dining Healthy, where we did an additional 300 surveys just on consumer health practices. So coughing, sneezing, serving dirty or expired food, all of those things, and cross-indexing it with the employment and health and safety issues. And in fact, during the time that we were doing that additional 300 surveys, we also collected hundreds of anecdotes from workers who said, I'm forced to work under severe time pressure, I'm cutting myself and the finger of the blood is falling into the food, or I'm forced to work doing several jobs at once, I'm burning myself and the burnt skin is falling into the food. And during the time that we were collecting these surveys, there were 3 news reports that came out of people actually biting into fingers in their salads. And so we know that it happens. We actually went and interviewed the workers who had cut their fingers and it had been served to somebody who actually bit into their finger. We also found that the high road is possible. So we were able to, through the employer interviews, show that, in fact, there are really great employers who have the same price steak as their neighbor who are providing health insurance and paid sick days and a really safe and healthy working environment. So we held a huge summit in January of 2005, and it led to the creation of the New York City Restaurant Industry Roundtable, which is a regular convening that we created that has been really successful in promoting a different way of doing things. And I'll talk about that more in a second. I'm running out of time in a big way. So the project that we got funded for through NIOSH was even bigger. So that was, we did the first 2 reports, and this is actually the fourth. The third was a testing study where we sent 225 pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants to see who would get hired. That report's coming out in January. This report was our fourth report. We did 500 additional surveys of restaurant workers on health and safety in particular, 10 focus groups of workers, 35 employer interviews, an ergonomic assessment of colors, which I'll show you a quick clip about in a second, and a lot of peer education where we trained our members to do education on health and safety with their peers. You cannot see this at all, but I'll say in a nutshell that a lot of the same things we found in the first report were reinforced. So it's largely immigrant, largely people of color, you know, people working in the industry for a very long time, so this is not the transient industry that everybody thinks it is. This is not the industry where you come in and you go out and you become a student or an actor. For most workers, this is a career industry. It's just that they cannot stay in one place for very long because the wages and working conditions are so bad, so they're having to move from establishment to establishment. But the key thing that we found in this study that was so great was that we cross-indexed exposures in terms of chemical exposures and ergonomic exposures with outcomes, and then we regressed that on benefits. And so we were able to show that actually workers who do not have any kind of health benefits were more likely to have stiffness and pain and injury and illness. And then we again regress that on the consumer health practices to show that, in fact, there is a consumer problem. There are problems for consumers for workers not having these benefits and having the injury and illness. So we took all of the studies that we had done one step further to show there really is a connection with lack of job benefits in terms of people's injury and illness and other kinds of, you know the terminology better than I do, psychosocial and other outcomes. All right. So this is all super important for us. I know, you know, other folks will talk about the research in more depth. I wanted to talk a little about how this is actually used on a practical level. And so we were able to create a piece of legislation in the New York City Council that says that restaurant employers that violate labor laws would actually lose their operating license through the City Department of Health because it's a health concern, not just a workers' rights concern. And we've been really successful in pushing that forward. Our research was really key in getting a statewide minimum wage increase in New York State. And we are using the data that we're finding out of this NIOSH report as the basis for benefits, for fighting for paid sick days in New York State and New York City. And we did this all on the basis of organizing undocumented workers. So people always say, how can undocumented workers have a role in policy work? Well, in fact, ours were responsible for getting a statewide minimum wage increase in New York State, and they've been all over the Capitol and City Council and everywhere else. So the high road. We've actually worked with about 25 to 30 good employers who are doing the right thing. We worked with them to create a restaurant owner guide. So we asked them, what do you think we could do together to promote better working conditions? They actually said, let's work together to educate other employers on these issues. Together, we created a restaurant owner manual that the city has paid for publishing and distributing to every restaurant owner in the city on an annual basis. Mayor Bloomberg paid for that. And also for running a boot camp, which is a two-hour free monthly training for restaurant owners on these same issues. We wrote it, so our members, our workers wrote it, how to run a good restaurant, and Mayor Bloomberg hands it out. And we also do a ton of employer training for people on how to run a good restaurant, and part of that has been having our own restaurant and being able to use it as an ergonomic model. So we were able to bring in an ergonomist from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine to design the restaurant as an ergonomic model and do assessments pre and post. I'll show you a really quick news clip about the restaurant. So you get a sense of what it is that we're doing.
It was just one of many businesses destroyed on 9/11. And of course, it sat on top of the North Tower. Now, some of the remaining employees are remembering the friends they lost by finally realizing a dream. American Morning's Kelly Wallace has their story this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, that's such a nice story because the dream was owning a restaurant all by themselves, many of them immigrants, so that they would own and operate this new restaurant. It started serving the public last week, but it will celebrate its official grand opening this coming week.
The seafood school.
Madi Labib's from Egypt, John Pierre's from Haiti, and Silveria Moose from the Philippines. Three men from dramatically different backgrounds, but forever linked by a date, a restaurant, and routine scheduling that ultimately saved their lives.
Thank God. The sous chef that, you know, we're doing construction on the floor, and they told me, you know, you don't have to come in until 10 o'clock. So, and that's the reason I'm here today.
73 of their friends, their colleagues at the World Trade Center's Windows on the World were not as lucky. They died at work on September 11th, and more than 4 years later, it's still tough to look at photos of people and a place they used to see every day.
I get, you know, a little bit of goosebumps or something every time I remember them.
Yes, raise your hand.
In a tribute to their lost colleagues, they, along with about 50 restaurant workers, many of whom are immigrants who also worked at Windows, joined together to open Colors, one of New York City's first worker-owned restaurants. Is this a dream come true? You are a part owner of a restaurant in New York City.
New York City, which is a very tough place to be. But we're going to make it very well. I feel terrific.
And this is not just about remembering lives lost, they say. It's also about changing lives. Workers will get a share of the profits if there are any, and no one earns less than $13.50 an hour, far higher than what an average restaurant pays.
Right here, you have a bunch of immigrants that owns a restaurant. You know? How crazy is that, right? So it's like, a lot of people now, they can look up to us and say, we can do it. We can be owners. We could be better in life.
Just about every owner has submitted a recipe from their home country for the menu.
We call it lumpia.
Philippine lobster lumpia from 41-year-old Silverio and from Magdy, a father of two.
Nothing yet.
Nothing yet.
Nothing yet. I didn't like it.
They didn't like your recipe.
No, I really did, but
we gotta take that up with the owner.
No,
oh, wait, you are an owner.
Talking to me.
Success, though, is no sure thing.
If it doesn't work, we'll try again. Maybe a smaller place. You know, we're not gonna give up.
The memory of their friends driving them to realize a dream born out of tragedy. And it is a dream that took more than 3 years and $2 million to realize. And Soledad, a dream that faces very big challenges because a recent study found that nationwide, new restaurants, 60% of new restaurants fail within 3 years.
Yeah, the odds are not with them, especially the New York restaurant business. Where did they get the $2 million from?
They got about $500,000 from a cooperative, another restaurant food cooperative in Italy. The rest of the money, though, coming from faith-based social groups. They say getting this money, Soledad, you would think a lot of people might have wanted to invest in it, but it was very hard to get the money, and they seem to get money from these groups that want to invest, but also want to make a social message, you know, helping immigrants and helping workers become owners as well.
And it almost sounds like the owners now have their own message they want to give too.
They do. They say immigrants have not been very well treated often in restaurants. Sometimes they're in the back of the restaurants. You know, dishwashers maybe make $7 or $8 an hour, can't move up. They're saying at this restaurant, they're going to get health care, they're going to get good wages, you can be a dishwasher for 1 year, then a few years later, maybe you can be an assistant to a chef. So they're hoping to send a message.
Opportunity.
Also, so that the better you treat your workers, we know this across the board, the better services they'll provide. So having these owners be invested in this process, they think they're going to have, you know, a better product they'll turn out.
Oh, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
And it's in Greenwich Village, you said, on Lafayette Street.
Near the place.
So anybody comes to Greenwich.
Okay, so that very last line about the better you treat your workers, the better services they'll provide is precisely why we've worked so hard to do all this research to show that it's actually not just workers who suffer when they're not treated well or they don't have good health and safety conditions, but consumers as well. We've created this whole new frame called collective prosperity. We're going around the country talking about it. A book has just been written about our work, and a movie's coming out called The Accidental American. And it really is all about, you know, we've gone national. We now have a rock. We're starting another Colors in Detroit, Michigan, where we were able to buy a restaurant for the same price as we pay in monthly rent in New York. We also have New Orleans and Maine. We're opening up Miami and LA in early next year. But the whole point is that we cross-index the data. It was so important to us to cross-index the data with these public health outcomes because of this idea of collective prosperity. Thank you.